Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Michael Masters. He is professor of anthropology at Montana Tech. His research centers on investigating human ocular, orbital, midfacial, cerebral, and neurocranial morphology, and how competition among these features may act to constrain the eye and surrounding ocular tissues during ontogeny. Further research interests center on investigating hominin biocultural evolution, astrobiology, astronomy, and the physics of time as they relate to the UFO phenomenon. On that peak, Dr. Masters has written a book, Identified Flying Objects, a Multidisciplinary Scientific Approach to the UFO Phenomenon, and that will be the focus of our conversation today. So, Dr. Masters, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show.
Absolutely. It's great to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, great. So, I mean, this UFO phenomenon, from a scientific perspective, isn't it a little bit controversial? Because, I mean, what we know about it, doesn't it come basically from people's reports, people's testimonies, what people say they see and hear, and so on, and some unreliable, I guess we could say, footage and things like that. So, I mean, from a scientific perspective, with the sort of data that we have at our disposal, isn't it a little bit unreliable to study this phenomenon?
It is if you're just looking at those things that you mentioned. Absolutely. We really can't consider people's personal experiences as evidence in the strict sense of the term from a scientific standpoint. It can be brought as evidence in a courtroom, for instance. You can have a witness testimony, but those sorts of accounts don't really hold up in the context of scientific inquiry. So this book is a little bit different in the sense that it draws from long-term evolutionary trends in hominin evolution, specifically with regard to our craniofacial morphology, changes that were initiated beginning with bipedalism, the evolution of our culture and technology, and looks at how these enduring trends, if they continue, the ones that have persisted for 6 million years up until now, if they continue into the future, we would expect to look and act and have things like those beings that are reported in so many of these different accounts. So it tries to connect these pieces, drawing from those witness testimonies and videos that have been shot and other accounts that people have had. But it's mostly a look at long-term hominin changes and what we might expect to see if we continue those changes. And I would like to point out, though, that you're right. A lot of what people conceptualize as UFO footage is grainy. It's just lights moving around erratically. But it is important to acknowledge that just this year, the United States Navy acknowledged that some videos that they captured from some of their gunner pilots that were they were made aware of them by some radio operators in the USS Nimitz specifically, that those were confirmed by the Navy to be genuine and things that far surpass our technology that we have today. So I think it's important that people also consider that when our armed forces are acknowledging that there is something happening, then it's up to us as scientists to investigate it. We can't just throw up our hands and say, I don't know. That's unscientific. We're not doing our jobs if we just say, well, it's stigmatized or we don't understand it, so let's just ignore it. That's not what we are expected to do as scientists. We're expected to ask the big questions and to try to understand things that are mysterious and that need further explanation. So yeah, even though it's still stigmatized and is somewhat controversial in some circles, that's changing and that's changing rapidly. And I think it's going to be important for us to understand this phenomenon to get out ahead of it. And it's definitely something that scientists should be doing.
So, I mean, when we talk about the UFO phenomenon, people usually associate it with alien spaceships and alien beings, some sort of alien beings. And I mean, most of the reports that we have from people are of objects moving in the sky or them being abducted by what they call aliens or some creatures like that. But the thesis that you put forward in your book, if it is correct at least, it refers to human beings as they would evolve in the future. And time traveling, that is the sort of machines that people would see in the sky, would have been time traveling machines or time traveling spaceships. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. It's a very simple model. Also, going back to what you were talking about earlier with the controversy, one thing that's important about this model is that it is testable. It's a testable hypothesis. Simply making a prediction about what the future state of humans might be. And we can speculate about what might be out there in space, what might not be. But at the end of the day, there's no way to fully test an extraterrestrial hypothesis. But this one, rooted in just the continuation of the same long-term hominin trends that have characterized our own evolution on this planet over the last 6, possibly 8 million years, if those continue into the future, we would expect to have this form and expect to have this technology. So at some point in the future, we will know whether or not this model is accurate or not. It's falsifiable in that sense. So that's one thing that makes it more scientific with regard to the scientific method and how a hypothesis must be falsifiable to even be considered. But yeah, you're right. The crux of the argument is essentially that some specific changes that have taken place in hominin evolution, most notably, is our bipedalism. We walk upright, and that initiated a number of other changes in our morphological form. Specifically, our heads had to rotate down, and as that happened, it created a flexing of our basocranium, the part of the skull where the brain sits, just inside the calvarium and underneath the brain. And as that happened, it created this expansion of our neurocranium, an expansion of our cranial cavity, and our faces began to retract. You can't have a big bulbous head and a big projecting face. If you look at dogs, they're a good example of that, where you have Doberman pinschers with a very linear facial structure, and then you have pugs and chihuahuas and other things with big foreheads and small faces. So that's been a dominant trend throughout hominin evolution in association with our upright walking. So in looking at these reports, again, to try to tie it into this phenomenon and to make sense of something that's very misunderstood in our culture today, if, like I've said 100 times, if these beings had been described as giraffe-like creatures or squids or octopi or something like that, I never would have written this book. But they're ubiquitously described as being upright walking humanoid beings with a larger, more globular neurocrania, a rounder head, a more retracted face, hairlessness, technology that's evolved far beyond our own, the ability to communicate with us in our languages. All of these things that are described so consistently throughout these reports very much indicates that they are just simply us from the future. So the book takes a very critical look at this. I'm not trying to make any blanket claims about the reality of this phenomenon or that this is the truth and everybody must jump on board with this time travel model. Nothing like that. It's just trying to put forth a model that helps to explain as much of the strangeness associated with this phenomenon as possible. And it does so in a very conservative, grounded, down-to-earth sort of way.
But then, when it comes to the description of the physical features of those organisms that you would say could be humans from the future, I mean, you are relying on people's reports of the kinds of beings they supposedly have contact with.
I mean, yeah, obviously, to some extent, we must look at those in the context of this phenomenon. We have some videos that I mentioned that have been acknowledged as genuine, by the Navy. But outside of those, yeah, it's mostly people's reports, what they describe seeing. And honestly, if that many people describe the same thing throughout the world and across such long periods of time, why wouldn't we believe them? It's very unlikely that so many people would just make up something so consistent and so strange without any sort of stimulus, without something that actually happened to them. So yeah, I don't think that thousands and thousands of people are lying. And I don't think that we should just dismiss those things because they have been stigmatized and we've been forced to think of these people as crazy shoeless hillbillies that are drunk and stumbling around the wood at night. I think that undermines them, who they are as people, and the experiences that they had. So again, even though we can't consider that evidence in a scientific sense, if they are describing beings from our future who are going to exist on this planet at some point in our distant future, possibly tens of thousands of years into that future, what these people are seeing would simply be the connection of these two different points in time. So again, the book sort of looks at long-term evolutionary changes, how these might look in the future, and the fact that that prediction or that those models that indicate what we might look like are so consistent with these reports, I think should at least be acknowledged. So yeah, again, the book doesn't hinge on these reports. It doesn't even hinge on the reality of the phenomenon. Honestly, the whole thing could be bunk and the book will still stand as an interesting look into our past and look into our potential future. But I do think that these people are telling the truth, and I do think that their story should be considered in our modern time.
Mm-hmm. But there's still a big element or ingredient of speculation there in terms of, okay, so we've had these 6 million or whatever years of this kind of evolution, I mean, with these different physical features changing in particular ways. But, I mean, nothing tells us that in the future we would be exposed to the same sort of selective pressures that would lead in that direction.
Yeah, and I acknowledge that very early in the book, and actually don't speculate at all about what types of evolutionary pressures we may face in the future. I see those as irrelevant to this book and this conversation. And a lot, it's hard not to do that. A lot of people want to say, and I've heard this so much since publishing the book, that they think that we'll live in space at some point and our eyes will have to get bigger because there's less light. And I don't do any of that in the book. I go out of my way not to, because we can't know. There's no way that we can know what's going to happen in our future and how that might impact our physiology and culture. Rather, what I do is look at the long enduring trends in hominin evolution, which regardless of what happens in our future, whether we live on Mars or underground or on a space station somewhere, are likely to continue based on factors associated with our biocultural evolutionary history. There's certain things that even outside of our politics or economic system or where we lived in the world, they still trended in the same direction. We still trended toward hairlessness, less hair density and size. We have the same hair density, we have the same number of follicles per square inch as the chimpanzee. Our hair's just gotten much smaller and it disappears in many men with male pattern baldness. That trend has been going on for almost 2 million years. This trend toward increased cranial capacity is a 6 million year old trend. Reduction in our facial size, our dental structures and our dental size, neurocranial globularity, these big bulbous heads that we have now, that's a 200,000-year-old trend. So even outside of what might happen in our future, you're right, we can't know that and we shouldn't speculate about those things. This book rather looks at our physical form in the context of long-term physical and cultural changes, how those have interacted over time, and how they're likely to persist regardless of what happens to us in the near term or in the long term. We are still likely to see these same enduring trends that have characterized hominin evolution over this 6 to 8 million year period.
Mm-hmm. But by presenting this hypothesis, are you saying that it is just an alternative to these beings and these objects that we find in the air being aliens and alien spaceships? Or are you really saying that it is much more likely for these objects to be time-traveling machines and the beings inside them humans from the future?
Yeah, if this is a real phenomenon, and after extensive research, I very much think it is, as do many, many other people, especially those who have had an experience. I haven't. I haven't even seen any strange lights in the sky or anything like that. So in a way, I feel kind of saddened by that. I would like to have had some sort of experience. But at the same time, it also allows me to remain more skeptical, I think, where having nothing to draw from, no personal experience, I'm not using a filter in that regard, I guess you could say. But if this phenomenon is real, and we think about the unlikelihood that we would ever have two organisms that happen to evolve on planets close enough to each other that they could communicate or find each other in the vastness of our galaxy or even beyond in the universe, who would happen to have the same course of evolution with on planets with the same chemical structure and physical properties and distance from their sun and gravity and all of these other factors that would have to go into making an upright walking humanoid form. It just seems tremendously unlikely that that would not only happen with two planets close enough to each other, but at the same time, and that this one would just be slightly more advanced than our own, but still have all of these same characteristics. So if the phenomenon is real and these humanoid beings that are so ubiquitously reported are indeed the ones that are piloting these craft, the most parsimonious explanation is just that they're us, that have evolved beyond us on the same planet. We don't see them now because they live in the future in the same way we don't see people that lived 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago because they lived in the past in the same place. It makes more sense. Following Occam's razor, it's just a simpler explanation for this phenomenon if it is indeed real.
Mm-hmm. So let's now talk a little bit about time traveling. Could you tell us what are some of the most important physics concepts and phenomena that we would have to understand to be able, or that people, my audience, let's say, would have to understand to be able to better comprehend what we're talking about here than the kinds of technologies that humans in the future would have to develop to be able to time travel?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously an important part of understanding this model. And most of what I did in the book, not being a physicist myself, I'm a biological anthropologist, so I focus on the long-term evolutionary changes as we've been discussing. But I did start out as a physics and astronomy student as an undergraduate, and it's always been a deep interest of mine. So what I did is I drew from modern literature, mostly peer-reviewed journal articles from the field of physics to try to build a more holistic case. I also do that with astronomy and astrobiology because those are important to the conversation as well. But the main thing to understand for your audience is the most dominant model in physics right now for how we understand time is in the context of what's known as block time or landscape time. So it looks at all of these four dimensions of three dimensions of space, one dimension of time, Minkowski space-time is a four-dimensional entity, as one and giant block, so that you have from the very beginning of the universe all the way to the very end of time itself when the last matter disappears from the universe, all of the moments within that can be thought of as one giant four-dimensional block. And it's really hard for us to conceptualize that and to picture it because we can't picture four dimensions at the same time, especially when we're talking about three dimensions of space with changes moving out as four-dimensional entities all encapsulated in the same four-dimensional block. So within that framework, though, of universal block time, if you're moving in and out of different periods of it, you're moving into the past, and any interactions with that past are already there. You have already done those things before you even left. It's non-disruptive in the sense that any changes you were going to make, if we can even consider them changes, already existed. They were already embedded in that past, and any implications of that interaction have already manifested themselves into the future, up into the point when you left. Because all of time can be seen as this one giant block with these interconnections, this web of interaction that can take place. And a lot of why people don't really understand time in this way is because it's presented in so many different ways in pop culture, so many different movies and TV series just kind of make up whatever they want because it's entertaining and it's useful for their storyline. But when you look at time in the framework of physics and how physicists understand it, and philosophers and psychologists and sociologists and others who study time, it's not just physicists, you start to see how moving throughout different periods of it isn't problematic. There aren't paradoxes in the same way that we conceptualize them or we see in these different forms of media. So to your question specifically about how this might happen, another thing I do in the book is look at sort of the history of how we understand the possibility of physically achieving backward time travel. Really, since Einstein's papers on general relativity in 1915, when he gave us a number of field equations that really broadened our awareness of how the universe works and how space-time works and how gravity and speed can alter the rate of passage of time in the context of special relativity initially, and then general relativity in 1915 when he published those papers. And since then, it was actually very shortly after 1918 that Hans Thuring and Joseph Lenz published the Lenz-Thuring effect, papers on how massive bodies that rotate can warp space-time, and they can allow light cones to bend over. And a light cone, for those of your audience members who might not understand this, if we think of turning on a flashlight, light radiates outward. And so we can make this cone, because light is a barrier for all physical entities, we can understand that as that light propagates outward, all things must take place within the boundaries of this light cone, simply because nothing can move faster than light. So what that means is that if you have the rotation of a massive or highly energetic body, and it allows those light cones to reorient toward the past, then you can travel locally still into the future. You're still moving forward in time in the same way that we understand it and we feel every day. But globally, you're traveling into the past. You're traveling into the global past simply by still moving forward, but in the context of the rotation of this massive body. And so it draws from the early work of Van Stockham, Gödel, the Gödel universe, Frank Tipler, and recent research that still looks at how we might achieve backward time travel, that still consistently, just like all of these other studies, looks at the rotation of a massive or highly energetic body. And what's interesting about this and connecting the dots again with this UFO phenomenon in the same way that we might be able to with our physical biological form is that it almost always involves the rotation of a cylinder, a sphere, a ring, or oftentimes a disc. And these UFOs are so commonly described as being disc-shaped, massive, highly energetic bodies. Exactly what we would expect looking at the long history of research over the last 100 years into how we might achieve backward time travel. So we have this idiom in biology that form follows function, and it's very possible that the form of these UFOs allows for the function of backward time travel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a lot there. Do you think that we have all the theoretical foundations and also, probably the kinds of technology that we have at the moment are not enough to do that, but at least the physics theoretical foundations that it's good enough, at least for us theoretically, to develop a piece of technology that would allow for us to time travel?
No, I don't think we're anywhere close to that, to be honest. I think, and I bet that almost every physicist would agree with this. For that to happen, we're going to have to understand the relationship between quantum physics and general relativity. These things, we don't understand time yet, and to truly understand time and how we might traverse time, it's easy to go forward in time. You just travel fast or sit on the edge of a highly gravitational body. But to travel backward in time, I think almost every physicist would agree that we're going to need a theory of quantum gravity. We're going to need a theory that unites the fields of quantum mechanics and general relativity. And until that happens, it's going to be hard to really understand how we do this, the logistics of this. And then you're right, the engineering part is a huge issue too. The materials needed that can withstand the forces that it would take to warp space-time to such an extent that you can travel into the global past. It's going to take materials that likely won't be developed for hundreds or possibly thousands of years. And that's just my opinion. I'm just based on what we know now, it's likely going to be a while before we have the ability to do this.
And this warping of space-time, is it what physicists call wormholes? Is that what we're talking about here?
There's similarities, absolutely. Wormholes are more of a black hole that's being propped open by some sort of exotic material, as Kip Thorne and his students referred to it as, sort of the pioneers of wormholes and the whole idea. And it's similar in the sense that you're connecting different points in time. But with wormholes, you're mostly connecting different points in space and time, obviously, because you can't separate those. So that's more of a theoretical way of moving rapidly across the universe or the galaxy to a different region because you're bending those two regions together. You have these massive bodies that are able to warp. Kind of if you think of a sheet of paper, you bend those toward each other and then you make a hole through it to connect those two. And in that sense, it's more of a space travel thing, but also time travel and cutting those corners. But with this, it's more about looking at an object that's able to stay in the same place and or possibly travel at high speed in order to move faster into the global past. But something that's not really jumping through space, rather just jumping through time. It's possible that that machine, that UFO, and this is very commonly reported in these close encounters, is that it just appears or disappears in the sky. And that is something that we would expect of a machine capable of changing its position in that fourth dimension. Because if we see something suddenly appear or disappear, it indicates that it's maintaining its position in all three dimensions of space, but simply changing where it exists in time. And so that is, again, something else that I think should be considered and is consistent with what people describe in these reports.
And I mean, to make these warps in space, in the space-time continuum, to be able to time travel, would we need to develop some sort of specific technology? I mean, would it be the technology doing that, or would we perhaps need to exploit the mass or energy of particular cosmic objects or celestial objects or something
Yeah,
like that?
that's a good question. I mean, I obviously can't know the answer to that at this point, but I would guess that, and based on the physical properties of these craft as described in people's reports, whether they be reliable or unreliable, depending on who the individual is, it almost seems that that is the time machine itself. So, in some sense, there could be help from a neutron star or a black hole in the context of manipulating space-time. But just based on what's described and the long history of how we've come to understand the physics of backward time travel and how this craft seems to be consistent with the form that we would need in order to do this, I would speculate, and I am speculating here, that that is the actual time machine, that this rotating disc-like, highly energetic craft is what's actually allowing them to do it outside of any celestial body.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, now perhaps let's just go through a final topic, and this will include two different types of questions. So the first one is, why do you think that people in the future would time travel to the past? I mean, what would they have to gain from that?
Oh, man. Well, I'm kind of biased in that regard because that's what we do as anthropologists. We study the past. We study how humans change through time. And I've worked on so many archaeological, historic, prehistoric, paleo, anthropological digs, and just being able to be there in that same place, but at that time, when our hominin ancestors were living, we could learn so much more about who they were and what they did and their behaviors and their culture, the things that don't preserve, especially prior to stone tools, before we had culture. We could know so much more about our own past. And that would apply in many different fields, I'm sure, even beyond anthropology and paleoanthropology specifically. Geologists could learn so much more about the past, or sociologists, or really anyone that studies the past or the studies the evolution of any sort of phenomenon or physical entity. And outside that, I do feel like this is mostly a research-driven thing. And I think one of the only ways to probably get permission to go to the past, simply because of what might happen if there's an accident, it's dangerous to do so. Not because it creates paradoxes, but it does complicate the interaction across time that doesn't exist if there's not an accident. If something does happen, something goes wrong, it can definitely impress itself upon time in different ways. So it may be that the only ones who are allowed to do backward time travel missions in this regard are scientists, are people with a specific objective to try to find something out, to answer a big question. And that may help explain these abduction reports too, because the things that are so commonly reported by these abductees are exactly what I would do as a biological anthropologist if I had access to this technology. I would take them up, I would lay them on an examination table, I'd basically do a biomedical examination, take hair samples, skin samples, fecal samples, semen samples. The fecal samples could be the whole anal probe aspect of it too, why that's so commonly reported. So if I had that technology, I would be doing these exact same things in our own evolutionary past, rather than digging up the fossilized remnants of our distant ancestors or looking at little broken tools from 2 million years ago. If we could just impose ourselves in that time period, in those places where they existed, we would have a wealth of information available to us instantly. So I think that a big part of it is simply research, though the ones that are just kind of seen hovering among the clouds or not really being too overt in their operations, there could be a time tourism aspect to that too. It could be people who paid an exorbitant amount of money to travel into the past to see one of their favorite periods in history, or to see the pyramids being built, or Machu Picchu, or any number of things, even the most benign things, or possibly wars that took place that people are fascinated by. So I think as far as the more overt interactions, abduction cases, that's probably research. And the just simple observation of UFOs in the sky could be tourism. But again, that's not something we can know until we get to that point and we become the ones doing it, or at whatever point they feel that they can finally connect those different points between now and then, and acknowledge what they've been doing and explain to us why.
But that example of touristic backwards time travel would be an example of an economic gain that people from the future could get from that. But I mean, outside of the strict purview of science and scientific endeavor and anthropology more specifically, do you think that people from the future could also get some political, economic, social gains by doing that, by traveling to the past?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how. I can't think of any way in which that couldn't happen. I think in the same sense that there would be rules, and again, I'm just speculating because I can't know why they do what they do, but just based on the behaviors and how much they try to not be enumerated in these different time periods in the past, it would indicate that there are rules, there's guidelines. And like I said, research missions might be the only way in which they can actively interact with members of the past. But yeah, that question of getting rich off of knowing what's going to happen in the future. If I went back to the year 2000, I've got a long list of stocks I would buy at that time that would make me extremely rich right now. And that would be great. So because it is possible to do that, to manipulate economic and political situations for personal gain, I think that there would probably be strict protocols in place. It's also going to be prohibitively difficult to just do this. It's not like jumping in a DeLorean and going and getting some printouts of the results of sports events or any sort of stock market readouts or anything like this. It's going to take a lot of energy, an almost mind-boggling amount of energy to do this, to travel backward in time. And that's obviously going to take a lot of money, a lot of really sophisticated technology. So it's not like anybody's just going to be able to jump in one of these craft and go to the past and become president of some nation or become incredibly rich because they know something from the future. I think it's going to be prohibitive simply because of the energies, the materials, the physics of it, the knowledge that it will take to do this. And so I don't think that's necessarily going to be an issue, but it could be something that is in the future, and that could help explain why we don't just see them walking around the streets or showing up at sporting events with their big heads and their big round eyes and small faces and really nice clothes, because I'm sure they're making a ton of money off of using that information. But I don't know. It's definitely something I would love to know is what kind of rules are in place, who's allowed to do it, why those people and not others. And I hope that at some point in the future we do have these answers, and obviously preferably in my lifetime, but I'm not holding my breath on that one.
Yeah. So just one last question. Do you think that in our time it would ever be possible for us to prove that that those kinds of objects that people report on the sky and the organisms that they say they interact with are real, and then that if they are, they really correspond to humans in the future and the machines, to time-traveling machines?
Well, I think inevitably, yes, we will know. And like I said at the beginning of this show, that's one important aspect of this model that makes it different and makes it more scientific, is that at some point in the distant future, we will know whether we eventually get to be them and we're the ones coming back through time, or we annihilate ourselves and there's no more humans. Then we've tested this model. There's no one left to know, but we essentially have falsified this extratempestrial model at that point. So I would hope, and like I said just recently, that we could even know in our lifetimes. And that's not absurd to think so. One of the reasons why they are so hidden and so covert in their operations may simply be because We don't even understand time now. We don't talk about time. It dictates every aspect of our day-to-day lives, but it's not something that we really talk about or consider outside of certain circles within the physics community and cosmology and other places. But if we did start to really understand time and how the interaction of people across different times may not only be a reality, but these may be the ones doing it from our future. And if there is a broad awareness and acceptance of that, and it wasn't a scary thing, it wasn't like an H.G. Wells thing anymore, and we weren't afraid of some alien attack, then perhaps we could get that acknowledgement. We could get a period where we fully connect our present and our future, where we just interact with people from a different time in the same way that we currently interact with people from different continents, which was unheard of 600 years ago. So I think if we really do evolve our consciousness and our understanding as a society, not just within these certain pockets of academia, but as a society, then yeah, it's possible that we could have some of these answers, not 10,000 years in the future, but 60, 70 years in the future, possibly. And I'm really hopeful of that, but could just be wishful thinking, I guess, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So let's end the interview here, Dr. Masters. Again, the book is Identified Flying Objects, a Multidisciplinary Scientific Approach to the UFO Phenomenon. Before we go, are there any good places on the internet if people want to get in touch with your work?
Yeah, I have a website with a contact page, and there's also links to places where you can get the book online and information about speaking engagements and interviews and things like that. But it's just a shortened version of the book title, idflyobj.com. It's idflyobj.com. And that's a good way to get in touch with me or to find out more about the project.
Okay, great. So I will be including that in the description box of the interview so that people can go and check it out. It's very interesting. So Dr. Masters, thank you again for taking the time to come on the show, and it was a real pleasure to have you.
Yeah, it was great talking to you, Ricardo, too. Thanks for having me on.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. So to keep the channel sustainable, I would really like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. Otherwise, I also have links to PayPal in the description box of the interview. And if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Perel Galarsen, Lau Guerrero, Chantel Gelinas, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Brian Rivera, Sergio Condriano, Janne Henninen, Ricardo Vladimiro, Greg Healy, Adam Castle, Vega Giddy, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, David Diaz, Anian Kata, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Wittenberg, Arnaud Wolf, Dr. Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, and Bo Weingard. My four producers, Izar Webe, Rosie, Jim Frank, and Lucas Stafiniak. And finally, my executive producer, Michal Rujewski. Thank you for all.